You know how it is, you can't scroll for 5 minutes without bumping into some argument about God. It can feel like you need some ironclad proof just to even think religious belief is reasonable. But what if the whole game was different? What if belief itself could be like a rational starting point?
Interesting.
That's the mind-bending territory of reformed epistemology we're plunging into today, spearheaded by the influential philosopher Alvin Plantinga.
Exactly. For many, that constant pressure to justify deeply held beliefs, especially, faith-based ones, can be intense. The question of prove it just hangs in the air.
Yeah, definitely.
This deep dive offers a really powerful alternative. The idea that believe in God can be intellectually sound without needing those traditional sort of step-by-step arguments. We're unpacking a truly significant shift in modern philosophy.
And our roadmap for this intellectual adventure comes from excerpts of a lecture by Dr. Jim Spiegel on reformed epistemology, part of his broader series on the philosophy of religion. Okay, so, to really grasp why Plantinga's ideas caused such a stir, we kind of need a quick trip back in philosophical history. Let's start by looking at a movement called logical positivism.
Right. To really appreciate Plantinga's move, you absolutely need to see the intellectual landscape he was reacting to. Logical positivism, championed by figures like Moritz Schlick and the Vienna Circle around the early 20th century, maybe the teens, 1917, 1918, they had a very specific aim: to anchor philosophy in something solid, something like scientific proof.
Yeah, they were pushing back against what they saw as these really abstract, almost floaty ideas that were, kicking around in philosophy at the time. They wanted to ground things in the real world and things you could actually verify. And that's where their big idea, the verification principle, came into play.
What's fascinating here is the core of that principle. A statement or belief, they argued, was only meaningful if you could, in principle, test it empirically, like scientifically. If it couldn't be scientifically verified, then for the positivists, it was outside the realm of real knowledge, cognitively meaningless, basically.
Which had some pretty huge, and as Dr. Spiegel points out, unfortunate knock-on effects, right? Suddenly, massive areas of human thought and experience were being dismissed as just nonsense.
Yeah, imagine that.
Imagine being told your feelings about beauty or your belief in basic morality were just empty words.
Precisely. If you took the verification principle seriously, then beliefs about right and wrong, our appreciation of art, the existence of God, even the idea of a soul, all were considered to have no real cognitive content, not genuine knowledge in any meaningful sense.
It's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it, but as Dr. Spiegel explains, this whole positivist thing eventually kind of fell apart, right? It had a pretty fundamental problem baked right in.
That's a crucial point to understand, yeah. The inherent flaw, the way logical positivism contradicted itself, became more and more obvious. The verification principle itself, the claim that only empirically verifiable statements are meaningful. Well, can you actually verify that claim empirically?
Good question.
Can you run a scientific experiment to prove the truth of the verification principle? No, you really can't.
So, by its own rule book, logical positivism ended up being meaningless. Talk about a philosophical mic drop
Work.
gone wrong.
Exactly.
But even though it didn't last, Dr. Spiegel emphasizes that this positivist mindset really hung around and influenced thinkers for decades. This idea that only what you can prove scientifically really counts.
Exactly. The skepticism towards religious claims that positivism fostered persisted well into the mid-20th century, shaping the intellectual climate of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It created a situation where not believing in God, atheism, or agnosticism became almost the default position for many academics.
And this is where we see people like Anthony Flew arguing for this presumption of atheism. It wasn't just about a lack of belief, it was about saying that the starting point should be disbelief, and believers have the obligation to provide really compelling reasons to change that starting point.
Yes. Flew's argument essentially put the burden of proof squarely on the shoulders of those who held religious beliefs. They were the ones who needed to provide the convincing evidence. This really set the stage for a lot of philosophical debate around religion.
You really get a sense of this shift when Dr. Spiegel mentions that 1966 Time magazine cover asking, "Is God dead?" I mean, wow. The rise of atheism in academic circles was a major topic, and the lingering influence of positivism and thinkers like Flew was clear. It felt like the intellectual ground was shifting away from religious belief.
That Time magazine cover really captured the mood, didn't it? It reflected a perceived decline in religious belief among intellectuals and highlighted the dominance of a secular perspective in many academic fields. And right in the middle of all this, as Dr. Spiegel tells us, a philosopher named Alvin Plantinga, was developing ideas that would directly challenge this prevailing view.
Yeah, so in the thick of this intellectual atmosphere, around 66, Plantinga was working on his book, God and Other Minds. And the central question he was wrestling with was pretty direct, wasn't it? Did you have to have evidence to make belief in God rationally respectable, to be, like, intellectually justified in believing?
That's the key question Plantinga was tackling head-on.
Yeah.
He was questioning that widely accepted assumption, you know, deeply rooted in that positivist legacy, that belief in God needed solid arguments and empirical backing to be considered reasonable.
And his conclusion, as Dr. Spiegel points out, was a resounding no. He argued that you didn't need that kind of knockdown, airtight evidence to be warranted in your belief in God. It was a real shakeup of the established way of thinking.
It was a fundamental challenge, absolutely. And Plantinga didn't stop there. As Dr. Spiegel notes, he further developed these ideas in his extensive Warrant trilogy in the 90s, finishing up in 2000. This body of work laid the groundwork for what we now know as Reformed epistemology.
Okay, so let's really dive into the core of Reformed epistemology. Dr. Spiegel starts by mentioning that Plantinga and others in this school of thought have a somewhat different perspective on the usefulness of natural theology, those traditional philosophical arguments for God's existence.
What's interesting is their stance. They don't necessarily dismiss all arguments for God outright, but they believe those arguments have limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Spiegel touches on presuppositional apologetics, which suggests that human sin can act as a kind of barrier, preventing people from accepting the evidence, even if it's presented clearly.
So it's like the problem isn't necessarily with the logic of the arguments themselves, but with something in the person, like something that hinders their ability or willingness to be convinced.
Right.
And Plantinga, Dr. Spiegel notes, adds other reasons for taking a more modest view of what natural theology can really achieve.
Exactly. The Reformed epistemologist approach suggests that we might be overestimating the power of purely rational arguments to lead to belief in God.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a crucial point. For them, this limitation isn't really a problem because they argue that believers don't need evidential justifications in the first place. They can, as Dr. Spiegel puts it, assume from the outset that God exists. And this leads us straight to their central idea. The concept of belief in God as properly basic.
Properly basic. Okay, that's the real engine of Reformed epistemology. So in simple terms, what does that actually mean? Dr. Spiegel gives us a straightforward definition. A properly basic belief is one that you hold, not because you've reasoned your way to it from other beliefs you hold. It's a starting point, not a conclusion.
That's right. It's a belief you accept without needing to first prove it from some other proposition. However, and this is really important, not based on other beliefs doesn't mean it's a completely random, unfounded idea. As Dr. Spiegel emphasizes, belief in God, according to this view, is still grounded in experience, in certain ways we encounter the world.
Yeah.
Think of it like seeing the color blue.
Yeah.
You just see it. You don't need to deduce it from other sensory data. It's immediate.
So it's not just a belief that pops into your head for no reason. It's connected to how we experience things, but it's not a conclusion we draw from those experiences in a step-by-step logical way. And Dr. Spiegel brings in this idea that belief in God is warranted. It's the right and natural thing to do when our cognitive abilities are functioning properly.
This is a key component, yes. The argument is that when our minds are working as they were designed to, belief in God will naturally arise in response to certain experiences. However, due to the impact of sin, Reformed epistemology suggests that we need a kind of cognitive redemption to restore our proper cognitive functioning when it comes to beliefs about God.
Which connects directly to John Calvin's concept of sensus divinitatis, that innate sense or awareness of God that humans possess. But sin, as Dr. Spiegel explains, can distort or suppress this sense, leading us away from belief.
Mm-hmm.
So this special divine help is needed to kind of fix our cognitive orientation. You can really see why it's called Reformed epistemology, with this emphasis on sin and God's restorative action.
Absolutely. The idea is that God has equipped us with this natural capacity to recognize him, but sin interferes with it. So faith in this framework involves a healing or restoration of that proper cognitive function. Now, to really understand why Plantinga believes belief in God can be properly basic, we need to look at his critique of something called classical foundationalism. This is the dominant way of thinking about how our beliefs are structured before Plantinga came along.
Okay, classical foundationalism.
Right.
This is a theory about how our entire system of beliefs is organized, yeah. Dr. Spiegel explains it as having like a base layer of fundamental beliefs that don't rely on any other beliefs for their justification.
Yeah, the foundation.
And then all our other more complex beliefs are built on and justified by this foundation. Think of it like a pyramid.
That's a good analogy. The core idea of foundationalism, generally speaking, is that our beliefs ultimately rest on a solid base of fundamental truths. But classical foundationalism adds a very strict requirement for what can count as a properly basic belief, those beliefs at the very bottom of the pyramid.
And this is where Plantinga takes issue, big time. Dr. Spiegel tells us that classical foundationalism says a properly basic belief has to be either self-evidently true, like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2.
Obvious.
Or directly obvious to our senses, like this table is brown. Or completely certain and immune to error, what they call incorrigible, like I'm currently thinking. That's a pretty high bar to clear.
It's an incredibly restrictive set of criteria. And Plantinga argues that if we stick to this strict definition, it actually excludes many perfectly reasonable everyday beliefs that we all hold and consider basic.
Right. Like Dr. Spiegel gives these great examples. The belief that the chair you looked at 5 minutes ago still exists, even though you're not looking at it now.
Yeah. How do you prove that?
Or that other people actually have thoughts and feelings like you do. Or that the world wasn't just created last Tuesday with all our memories implanted. I mean, we all take these things for granted. They feel basic to how we navigate the world. But can you definitively prove them with absolute certainty? Probably not.
Exactly. These are beliefs we rely on constantly, but they don't meet those super strict criteria of being self-evident, evident to the senses, or incorrigible. We can't produce a logically airtight proof that they're definitely true, yet we function perfectly well by assuming they are. This, Plantinga argues, shows that classical foundationalism sets the standard for proper basicality unrealistically high.
And then comes the really clever part, right?
Ah.
Dr. Spiegel mentions that Plantinga argues that classical foundationalism doesn't even live up to its own standards. Talk about a philosophical gotcha moment.
It's a brilliant move, really. The very statement that properly basic beliefs must be self-evident, evident to the senses, or incorrigible, is that statement itself self-evident?
Oh, no.
Can you see it with your eyes? Is it logically impossible to deny? No, it doesn't meet its own requirements. So just like the verification principle of logical positivism, it ends up sawing off the branch it's sitting on. Self-refuting.
So if we ditch this really narrow view of foundationalism, what does that mean for understanding what can be properly basic? Dr. Spiegel says it opens the door to a much wider, more common sense understanding.
Precisely. By rejecting the overly strict criteria of classical foundationalism, Plantinga argues for a more generous view of what kinds of beliefs can be properly basic. And his core point is this. If we're willing to accept beliefs like the reliability of our memory and the existence of other minds, which, as Dr. Spiegel points out, we can't definitively prove as properly basic.
Yeah, we all do.
Which we all pretty much do. Then, to be consistent, we should also be open to the idea that belief in God can be properly basic.
Mm.
Especially, as he emphasizes, since belief in God often arises naturally from various human experiences, feeling awe at nature, a sense of moral obligation, or a feeling of God's presence, things like that.
And it's not just this abstract belief in a God, but also more personal religious beliefs like God loves me, or those deep feelings of divine conviction. Dr. Spiegel highlights that these two can be considered properly basic within this framework. It's not just intellectual assent, but also these more direct personal encounters.
That's a really important distinction. It's not just an abstract intellectual acceptance of God's existence, but also these more immediate personal experiences and convictions that can serve as the foundation for properly basic beliefs about God. And then Dr. Spiegel lists a whole range of other beliefs that could be considered properly basic under this broader view. Things like our trust in our senses, the existence of an external world, the idea that causes produce effects, the general consistency of nature, and crucially, the existence of other minds.
And he makes a really insightful point about the existence of the external world, that what we're really assuming is that we're actually perceiving a real independent world and not just living in some elaborate simulation like the Matrix or something.
Exactly.
Those are fundamental assumptions we can't definitively prove. And then the connection he makes between belief in other minds and belief in God is really thought-provoking, especially when you remember the title of Plantinga's book, God and Other Minds.
This is a central analogy for Plantinga. We all interact with other people as if they have inner lives, thoughts, and feelings, even though we can't directly access their minds or prove their existence with absolute certainty. We just assume it based on behavior, language,
Yeah, we take it on faith, in a way.
In a way, yes. Similarly, Plantinga suggests belief in God can be seen as a properly basic belief in the ultimate mind behind the cosmos. Just as we are rationally justified in believing in other human minds based on our experiences and interactions, so too, by analogy, we can be rationally justified in believing in God as the ultimate intelligence and creator of the universe.
So, in a way, God is like another mind about whom we can have a properly basic belief. Of course, as Dr. Spiegel clarifies, Plantinga recognizes that God is not just one mind among many. He's the unique, infinite, all-powerful, all-knowing, and perfectly good mind.
Now, understandably, this idea of belief in God being properly basic has faced its fair share of criticism. Dr. Spiegel touches on a couple of the main objections.
Yes, as you might imagine, this was a pretty radical departure from traditional philosophical thinking, and it definitely sparked a lot of debate. One of the major concerns is the arbitrariness objection, the worry that if belief in God can be properly basic, then what's to stop people from claiming any belief is properly basic?
Right, like anything goes. Doesn't this open the floodgates to all sorts of irrational and unsupported ideas? That's the fear.
And what's Plantinga's response to that concern? Dr. Spiegel says he acknowledges that it's tricky to come up with a precise set of rules for what counts as properly basic. It's difficult. But he also points out that no one else has really succeeded in providing such a universally agreed upon set of criteria either, not for classical foundationalism, not for anything else. So he asks, why should the entire burden of proof fall solely on his shoulders? Just because he showed the flaws in the old way of thinking doesn't mean anything goes. There are still appropriate contexts and experiences that ground properly basic beliefs.
Exactly. Plantinga isn't suggesting that we can just arbitrarily declare any belief we fancy as properly basic. He believes there are appropriate circumstances and experiential grounds for properly basic beliefs, even if we can't always spell out a definitive checklist. And this leads to the second major objection Dr. Spiegel mentions, the famous Great Pumpkin objection.
Ah, yes, the satirical argument that uses that classic Peanuts Halloween special. If belief in God can be properly basic, why not belief in the Great Pumpkin, who rises from the pumpkin patch to deliver presents? It's meant to highlight the seemingly arbitrary nature of allowing belief in God without demanding evidence.
It's a memorable, if somewhat lighthearted, objection, but Plantinga's counterargument, as Dr. Spiegel explains, goes back to that idea of the sensus divinitatis, that natural human inclination to believe in God or some form of higher power.
That innate sense.
Exactly. He points to the widespread historical and contemporary belief in some kind of divinity across different cultures as evidence for this inherent human tendency, something that simply isn't there for made-up figures like the Great Pumpkin or, you know, the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Right. People don't naturally just start believing in the Great Pumpkin everywhere.
No. There's a fundamental difference in human experience and the pervasiveness of religious belief compared to belief in clearly fictional entities.
Right. It's that deep-seated human awareness or sense of the transcendent, however it manifests itself across different societies and throughout history. That's the key distinguishing factor for Plantinga. So despite these criticisms, Dr. Spiegel concludes that Reformed epistemology remains a highly influential and widely discussed perspective in contemporary philosophy of religion.
Absolutely. It provides a different framework for understanding the rationality of religious belief, suggesting that it's perfectly within our intellectual rights to hold a belief in God, even if we don't have traditional philosophical arguments to offer in its defense. From a rational standpoint, we can, in a sense, start with that belief as properly basic for many people.
So to sum it all up, the core idea of Reformed epistemology, thanks largely to Alvin Plantinga, is this. Belief in God can be rationally respectable as a properly basic belief without needing to be built upon prior evidence or logical arguments. It's a fundamental shift in how we think about the rationality of faith.
And for you, the listener, this offers a new way to think about your own beliefs and the beliefs of others. It suggests that the absence of hard scientific proof doesn't automatically mean a belief is irrational, especially when it comes to faith. It's a powerful idea that challenges some very deeply ingrained assumptions about knowledge and justification.
And it leaves us with a really fascinating question to consider. If some of the most fundamental beliefs we hold, the ones we rely on every single day without question, like other minds or memory or the external world, aren't based on absolute, irrefutable proof, what does that tell us about the very nature of human reasoning?
Mm-hmm.
What does it say about the foundations of how we understand ourselves and the world around us? It definitely gives you a lot to chew on and maybe even sparks a desire to delve deeper into the world of epistemology and the philosophy of religion.